The views and opinions expressed by Univarn during the Life in Equinox podcast do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Univarn. If that confuses you, don't worry, it just means you're normal. And why the hell are you listening to my podcast? That's right, normal people, I'm calling you out. Hi, my name is Univarn, this is a Life in Equinox podcast number 7. This is the podcast for Life in Equinox blog. You can check it out at univarn.blogspot.com. If you don't know how to spell Univarn, you're probably also normal. So, how do you spell it? U-N-I-V-A-R-N. That's univarn.blogspot.com. And on with the show we go. Got a jam-packed show. Okay, I lied. To be honest, we don't have a jam-packed show at all. We have a handful of movies I want to talk about. And I want to talk a little Oscar talk for ya. You know, all that fun, exciting stuff. Yay! That's a horrible voice, isn't it? I should stop doing voices on these things. People are feeling awkward. But no, I've got a lot of good movies I got to see this week. It was definitely one of those weeks where you never just have one of those weeks where you feel as if you never saw a bad movie. You didn't see a lot of great movies, but that was a good week for movies. I didn't have anything so horrible that it annoyed me, but nothing so great that, you know, I was jumping up and down for joy. So it was a good week. And a little bit of Oscar talk, because I don't know if you've known this, but if you're listening to my podcast, odds are you've heard that the Oscars announced their nominees this past week. A few snubs, a few not so snubs, but things I'm going to complain about anyways. We're going to bring those up. But first off, I'd like to kick this off. I haven't done this in a while, so I was going to give you a bit of, like, movie history with Ryan. And I've done this before, in case you're wondering who Ryan is. He's also Univarn. They're the same person. Now, don't get confused. I will explain later. A little bit of movie trivia from my past. And it starts, if you've known my, follow my blog at all, it probably doesn't surprise you that I have the attention span of about 5 or 6 minutes. So, as a kid growing up, I didn't really go to the movies a lot because I didn't have the attention span. I'd be sitting there, like, you know, sitting in my seat about to explode, just jumping up and down with energy. And so, what we would do is my mom would take us to the Dollar Theater. We used to have one down off Falls of the Neuse in North Carolina, for those people who know anything about North Carolina. Or, well, the Raleigh area. And we'd go down to this really cheap theater. The popcorn was like, you know, pre-pop back in the 40s, and it's still just in there, and you know, it's like horrible thing, but they had these nice chairs, and you get the cheap dollar theater food, you know, like they serve you meals, and it's like, what, is it the Dollar Theater, what, I don't understand, but one thing I remember is, and I got to talk to my mom recently about this, is she would always take us there, because I wouldn't have the attention span, and I'd be running around, and she'd always sit in the back, because I'd just run around the theater, about, you know, because I had that much energy. And so she'd always go to the Dollar Theater because if I did get too energetic and wound up and she couldn't control me, you know, she was out $3, then we could just kind of like sneak out the back and, you know, no big deal. Or nowadays, you know, if you go to Avatar, you drop $50. If your kid gets wound up and wants to leave, it's like, someone get the club, I'm knocking him out, we're watching the movie, he paid $50 for this. Got him. Whew, that's gonna hurt. Someone get some ibuprofen. I could definitely not get away with that today, but it was nice, and I don't, there's not a lot of dollar theaters around anymore. I know in Greensboro there's a couple of $2 theaters and $2.50 theaters, but what happened to the Dollar Theater? Those were awesome. You'd go there in the middle of the afternoon, you'd catch a movie everyone else in the world has seen already. Ah, those are awesome. I miss those days. That's right, I'm calling for a go back to cheap, crappy theaters. Make it happen, people. Alright, moving on. Let's get to the movies, shall we? Because that's why you're listening. You're not listening to me talk, are you? No! One of the movies I got to see this past week was Paul Thomas Anderson's Hard Eight. Now, if you don't know this, it's also known as Sydney. That was the original title, but the studio changed it to Hard Eight. And it's really Anderson's first film, you know, pre-Boogie Nights, pre-Magnolia, pre-everything. That's why it's his first. Gee, that's a shocker. Spoiler alert! Nah. And it stars John C. Reilly and Philip Baker Hall. And what it's about is Philip Baker Hall plays Sidney, this sort of mysterious man who shows up at a, I guess, kind of like a roadway diner where John C. Reilly's character, John, is sitting outside crying. And John is flat broke, has nothing at all in this world. He just lost it all in Vegas. And Sidney offers him a deal. I'll give you $50 and teach you how to make more. And John says he needs 6,000. And Cindy's like, why? And John's like, well, it's for my mom, whose funeral I have to pay for. And, you know, that sort of thing. And so Cindy helps him get the money. And over time, Cindy sort of becomes the mentor to John, the life, you know, the father figure he never really had. And I don't know how to really explain Hard Day. It's a little bit like, I don't know, kind of his style. You don't know really a P.T. Anderson film until you've really seen one. I mean, it's got a little bit of that Punch Drunk Love, a little bit of that Magnolia flair, but it's a very stylistic movie. Very noir, very quiet. Not a lot of action takes place, not a lot of movement. The first hour is pretty much just watching these characters, and it can be a little bit boring, I'd say, because while the characters are interesting, what they do isn't, because we follow Sydney for the most part, and Sydney's just a guy who kind of sits at a table and, you know, plays money, you know, around in Vegas, and he doesn't really do much. He just, you know, he goes from one table to the next table, maybe he goes and plays a game of craps, when you get to see a very young Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it's really kind of, it's an interesting character film, because as the film goes on, we don't really know anything about these characters, and in the final 30 minutes, a series of situations happen, and we learn all about the different characters, and we kind of get a little bit of insight into them. There's little subtleties and the things that they want and dream of and all that sort of stuff. And it's interesting to see how it develops. You can tell it's his first film. There's a little bit of sloppiness to the writing. It's not quite as well developed and rounded as you'd like it to be. But it's a solid film. It's good for a few minutes of entertainment, I'd say. I mean, it's not going to, you know, knock your socks off, but if you're a fan of Paul Thomas Anderson's style, his character-driven films, I'd recommend it. But we're going to get out of that. We're going to go to some more recent movies. You know, the modern-day films. But I actually had two and a half decent viewings. The first movie I got to see this week really was sort of the kickoff one, which was Jane Campion's Bright Star. Now, if you don't know anything about it, it was a British film, and it's about Fanny Brawn and John Keats, their romance, and how that sort of develops over time. And it stars Abbie Cornish and Ben Whishaw and a whole lot of actors whose names are all escaping me at the moment. I do apologize. As if they're going to listen to this podcast, right? But this is a lot of... the thing I remember most about Bright Star, and it's been a week, so, you know, I feel like an old man already. But no, I just remember it being so beautiful to look at. It's one of those movies you watch and you just kind of go, wow, that's just a beautiful scene. You know, there's the one where she's in the flowers and she's got the beautiful dress. And when I finished watching this movie, I immediately went on Twitter and I tweeted, Bright Star may be the most beautiful movie of the year. It's a shame the plot's not as beautiful. And I don't mean that the plot's not, you know, it has to be beautiful. I mean, it's just not as the strength. The images in this movie are so amazingly, like, lively. They bring so much of the movie to life. And I just felt like the plot weighed down the images, because we have a romance, and I'd put that in air quotes, you know, because the characters really only spend maybe 20-30 minutes of the film actually together. You know, there's about an hour of setup, and then they get together, and then he goes away, and then he comes back, and then he goes away again, and there's not a lot of, it's a lot of off-screen romance, you know what I mean? Like, he's over there, and she's here, and they're writing letters about how much they care for each other, and Abbie Cornish does an amazing job with this, because she pretty much is the only constant throughout the film, because characters are coming and going, her and her brothers and sisters, because it just felt like there's so much more they could have done. And I hate to say this, but I kind of wish they had fictionalized it a little bit, you know, fudged it a little bit, not so much with the how it played out, but with sort of spending more time with their time together, and not so much with their time apart. And I get that you need the build-up, because you have to sell everyone on the romance. And that's what the first act was for. You know, it's sort of that, you know, they put down a couple cards and they say, romance? I mean, if these five cards together don't spell romance, I don't know what does. And they does that well. I think it does a good job of setting up their initial beginning of the romance. at times I felt like they kind of skipped a few steps. They were like, we're going to go from like to smitten, from smitten to making out. Wait, isn't there, you know, a little seducing or maybe a little, I don't know, idle chat in between? Nope. Let's just go to making out. Yeah, just skip all those steps. Man, if only I could get romantic to go that quickly. But it works, I think, because of the acting. And it's grounded a lot in that performance from Abbie Cornish, who does an amazing job because she has to play so many emotions. She has to cry a lot. And by a lot, I mean a lot. She has to show that sort of, I don't know, disconnected lover, that one staring out the window looking for her true love, waiting for him to come back to her. And it works with them too. And I guess the performance that really kind of counters her is Paul Schneider, who I just had to look up. I apologize earlier because I can't remember names. Paul Schneider, who was in the assassination of Jesse James, if you happen to be one of the lucky people who watched that movie. And he does an amazing job here because he plays John Keats' best friend, but at the same time, he also plays sort of the emotional medium between Fanny Brawn and Keats. Because he wants to protect Keats from pain, and he wants to keep Fanny Brawn from hurting him. And at the same time, he sort of sees that this is not going to end well. He has that feeling. So he's kind of the villain to the romance. But Paul Schneider is such an amazingly good actor, I think he manages to carry it without playing the villain. Anyway, and towards the end, we see a lot of his heart and his emotion. He gets kind of his emotional moment. And it plays out well because his character is very sort of quietly unemotional throughout much of the film. Kind of, you know, the snide remarks, the, well, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Kind of, you know, over the top, mean, you know, grumpy guy. And so he does that very well. And I kind of wish he had gotten some recognition. Well, I kind of wish this movie had gotten more recognition for its visual. But with Abbie Cornish and Paul Schneider, it works so well because of them two. Without them two, I'm not sure it would have worked. And I'm glad that it did work because I would have felt a lot more sad if it wasn't for those two. Ben Whishaw is fine, but he didn't knock me out of the park at any particular moment. I kind of wanted more from him, but I don't think his character really had much to do because he's just kind of there. And we're going to move on to the next movie now. I know that's kind of sudden, but I don't really have any ability to do segues. And I got a chance to see this movie about a month ago. And I just never reviewed it, and I never really talked about it. And it's Steven Soderbergh's The Informant. And the reason I didn't talk about it is because I always feel kind of awkward, you know, 2 or 3 months after a movie's released, writing an indifferent review towards it. So I'll usually sit around and wait until, you know, it gets closer to DVD time, because then it matters again. I mean, who really cares, you know, about an indifferent review to a movie 3 months after it's been released and 2 and 3 months before it's going to go on DVD? Nobody. So I set it in my pocket, and I was like, you know what, its DVD's coming up in about a month. Might as well review it. And I know Mad Hatter gave it a really high score, I think like 3.5 stars. Don't quote me on that. He can correct me in the comments if he wants to. And I wasn't really all that impressed with it. I just found it very mediocre. I think Matt Damon is absolutely amazing in it, and I'm always up for a Joel McHale, but the rest of it? Huh? I didn't see what was so good about it. I mean, I guess that's why it got really split reviews from critics. The satire, I thought, was very unfunny. I could see he was like, oh yeah, that was a joke. Can we move on? You know, it never hit me anywhere, you know? And I wanted it to. I wanted it to be great and hilarious, because I love it when critics give a movie like a 40% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I go and I love it, and I'm like, ha, suck on them apples, this movie's hilarious. But this time, very, just, I can see what they think. I mean, it just felt a bit like a mess at times. It felt like it wanted to have more towards the end than it really did. And I never bought it. I never thought it was perfect enough. I think it just failed to capture the essence of itself. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it wanted to be a satire. I don't think it was a good satire. I think it would have been a much better personal drama. And I think the last 30 minutes or so kind of shows that. That while it is, you know, It is what it is. You know, it is a satire. It should have been a drama. And I hate to say that because I don't want to be the preaching guy, you know. Every movie must be a drama. But it's a movie I think that would have played better as a drama. It would have been more emotionally impactful. And we would have gotten to... You know, they could have snuck the satire and the jokes in. They didn't need to make that... They didn't need to make the guy the butt of the joke, you know? And it's kind of sad, but that's how it played out. But the last one I got to speak of is Bruce McDonald's Pontypool. This, I think I recently read it, and I don't remember who, but it said it was the best horror movie you haven't seen this last year. And Pontypool is really about this radio DJ, Grant Mazzi, who is played by Stephen McHattie, who was great in Watchmen. And if you get to watch the director's cut, there's an additional scene with him that's just absolutely beautiful. And he's working the morning shift at this small town radio station. You know, his wild, you know, loud mouth, cussing attitude has gotten him fired from the big stations. And so but they start to take calls, and, you know, they talk to calls about all these people who are standing outside of a doctor's office, and, you know, they're just mumbling words. They're not really doing anything. They're just repeating words that they've heard. And then all of a sudden a massacre happens. And all of this happens off screen. And so this entire film, we're in this DJ studio with Mazzy, his producer, and their sort of tech support kind of girl. I don't know what the technical term is for them. But, you know, they're in there and he's playing around with that. And they sort of, you get that sort of isolation fear, you know, that we're that claustrophobic sort of alien stuck in the room, we can't escape, and something horrible is happening outside, and we're stuck in here. And it plays off of that very well, because without that, I'm not sure it would have worked as well. Because when the big twist happens, you kind of find out what's happening. It gets a little kooky for its own self. It goes very over the top, almost absurd level. And I thought it was pretty funny. I'm not sure if it was intended to be a comedy as much as it was. But it worked a lot for me, because I thought it was really a lot of fun to watch. I was in it, and my hands were sweating, and I was like, oh my god, what's going to happen next? And I got into it, and, you know, Grant Mazzy's absurd, you know, cussing and his attitude, and it just reminds me a lot of these local, you know, wannabe big-time radio guys who are out there, you know, with the deep voices and all attitude and personality and opinion. But, it was a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it. If you don't mind horror films, a little bit of zombie lore, there's not a lot of violence to it. I can only think of really one scene of violence, and it is, you know, an emotional scene because of just the nature of it, but for the most part, almost pretty much every scene of violence takes place off screen. You know, there's a couple fight scenes, but, you know, the camera pans away, or it's just showing the faces of somebody. It's not really showing you the violence. So if you're not a big fan of violence, but you like horror films, this might be a good chance for you to get into a little bit of zombiness. And it was entertaining. And wow, I am going for a long time today. So, we're going to hop right into the last topic, which is the Oscars. Which, if you follow my blog at all, you'll know I put a post up this past week with all the lists and reactions that I could find from all my followers and people I follow, and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I'm going to just go into a few topics, just, I say, a few of the key ones. The first one being Best Picture. I wasn't really surprised District 9 got a nomination. I know a lot of people were. I guess the big surprise to everybody was The Blind Side. And I don't know what my opinion of that is. On one hand, I understand it. But it's such a mediocre movie, I don't know why it got in there. But I've read some people talking about this on a different websites, and how with 10 nominees, a lot of the people didn't really know where to go after the 5, because, you know, they'd go to the websites and everyone would say, well, these 5 are guaranteed, and then they'd have a list of 50 other movies that could possibly make it, and you're kind of just, you know, guessing. And let's be honest, 5,000 plus people vote on this. They don't have time to see every single possible movie that's released. And they get, you know, probably several hundred screeners of people saying, here, watch my movie. I want you to watch this one scene to get this one actor an award. You know, they don't have time for that. I mean, a lot of them are working and everything else, so they're kind of winging it, you know, oh, here's that thingy. Here, go. So, I guess The Blind Side just kind of gets in because it's one of those movies that probably all of them have seen. You know, it's one of the 10 movies they did see this year at the theater, type of deal. And so, I'm not surprised by it. I don't like it. I think it's an okay movie. I gave it, I think, a 6.75 or a 6.5, something like that. It's okay. It's not as horrible as everyone's making it seem. But it's one of those things that I think when you make it into the list, people who didn't like you to begin with all of a sudden really hate you because that one movie that they really love, like me, just kind of got bumped out for you. You know what I mean? Like A Single Man, I know a lot of people were big on that one, and that didn't get much nomination. But it's not like it's a crime against humanity or anything, so people can calm down a little bit. Everyone who's followed my blog knows the one movie I would have loved to have seen get a nomination anywhere, period, is Moon. But it didn't. You know, I'm fine with other people who got the actor in a leading role, supporting actor. I'm surprised Matt Damon got it for Invictus. I think that was a no informant nomination thing, you know, because sometimes they do that. It's like, we're not going to give you a nomination for this, but because I like you so much, I'll give you a nomination for this. That happens a lot. Actress in a leading role, I think that's just sort of how it's been playing out forever. But supporting role was an interesting one, because Maggie Gyllenhaal snuck in, and I don't think anyone, I can't think of a single person who called that. If they did, I mean, leave a comment, brag the hell out of it, because I don't think anyone out there was calling. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of great female supporting roles they had to pick from, and I think this was kind of like a, you know, a hand-me-down role, because and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, I haven't seen the movie, so can't really speak on Maggie Gyllenhaal's behalf, but a lot of times, it's just one of those things where you nominate the guy, you nominate the girl. You know, George Clooney gets nominated, then Anna Kendrick and Vera Farmiga get nominated. That sort of thing. And it didn't really bug me much. I think it would have been nice to see, I don't know, someone else in there. I think they had a lot of variety. Penelope Cruz, I mean, people keep talking about how, oh, you know, people are giving her the nomination because, you know, she's this or that. And it's like, she got her Oscar last year. We don't have to give her a throw-me Oscar nomination this year, despite the fact that nobody in the world hates watching Penelope Cruz walk down the red carpet. I think there's every guy out there who's going, Penelope Cruz on the red carpet in a dress. This should be fun. So, maybe there's that. Animated film, no idea what Secret of Kells is. Maybe we'll have to watch it now. Kind of depressed, no Miyazaki love for Ponyo on a Cliff by the Sea, but it wasn't his best work, so I can't blame them for that. The one category I've kind of been pushing around, though, a lot, and I don't really care about a lot of the other categories, you can complain and fight amongst yourself, is Best Score. And my biggest gripe, and while I love Clint Mansell's score for Moon, Sony did nothing to help for Moon, so there was no way it was going to get nominated, but Carter Burwell's score for A Serious Man and his deemed ineligible score for Where the Wild Things Are were so amazing. And Carter Burwell, if you don't know it, he's probably one of the best composers whose name you don't know. And he's been around forever. He did an amazing, amazing score the year before last for the movie In Bruges, which was one of my favorite movies of the year, if not my favorite movie. That's a highly debated topic for 2008 with me. And the score he does for that was so amazing, and he kind of does that same kind of, I don't know, quiet vibe for A Serious Man. And it's an amazing, amazing score. And where the love is it for, I don't know, what's wrong with you people, Academy? I mean, when you sit there and you listen to that, you have to just go, oh, that's an amazing score. I am glad they got Hans Zimmer for his great score for Sherlock Holmes, which really just reminded me a lot of the Ennio Morricone scores for the old Sergio Leone westerns. I don't remember the score from The Hurt Locker, so yeah, it didn't stick with me. I think everyone's kind of expecting The Weary Kind to win Best Song. We have all that sort of fun stuff going on. But this year, my opinion of the Oscars is very indifferent. I wasn't very passionate about any of the films nominated. Last year, I was passionate about Slumdog Millionaire, and I was passionate about Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and I was passionate about In Bruges. This year, the movies I'm passionate about didn't really get nominated. I mean, The Hurt Locker I was passionate about, but not so much. I admired it more than I loved it, and so a lot of my big films like Watchmen and Moon and Where the Wild Things Are and 500 Days of Summer, and they just didn't get any love. I mean, Up is probably going to be the movie I'm championing, and Hurt Locker is going to be the movies I'm championing, but the movies I really love and I'd watch again and again and again didn't get much love, and that's depressing to me. I wanted them to get the love. The love. They needed the love. But the Oscars didn't abide. Everyone can cry now. Solemn moment. Done? Good. Let's move on to the end. Wait, what? The end already? I know. It's been flying by for me, which probably means it's about 16 hours of your life is gone. And you're begging, why, God, Uni, why? Just stop! Stop the torture! And alright, I'll oblige. Thank you for joining me on Life on Equinox podcast number 7. My name has been Univarn. My blog has been Life in Equinox. You can find it at Univarn, univarn.blogspot.com. And you can check out this podcast at the same place or on iTunes. You can check it out via lifeinequinox.mypodcast.com. You can subscribe in there. You can do whatever you want, because this is the end. Bye.